On today's program, it's a delight to have Robert Moss make a return visit. We're talking about his newest book, Mysterious Realities, A Dream Traveler's Tales from the Imagined Realm. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. Hey, welcome to the program. Robert Moss has been a dream traveler since doctors pronounced him clinically dead in a hospital in Hobart, Tasmania, when he was just 3 years old. Actually, he talked about that once in one of his interviews on his program. From his experiences in many worlds, he created his School of Active Dreaming, his original synthesis of modern dream work and ancient shamanic and mystical practices for journeying to realms beyond the physical. He leads popular workshops all over the world, including a 3-year training for teachers of active dreaming and online courses for the Shift Network. A former lecturer in ancient history at the Australian National University, he is a New York Times best-selling novelist, poet, journalist, and independent scholar. His many books on dreaming, shamanism, and imagination include Conscious Dreaming, The Secret History of Dreaming, Dreaming the Soul Back Home, The Boy Who Died and Came Back, and Sidewalk Oracles. Robert's lived in upstate New York since he received a message from a red-tailed hawk under an old Wyatt oak. And by the way, his website is mossdreams.com. I encourage you to visit that. And he's on today's program from Upper State, New York. Robert Moss, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure talking to you, Richard.
This new book, Mysterious Realities, The Dream Traveler's Tales from the Imaginal Realm. How many books have you authored now?
Well, this is number 25, if you go the conventional way. You know, print books done in a conventional way. There have been audio books and video books and ghosted books and other things. But it sounds like a lot, Richard, but, you know, I dreamed a long time ago. I have a contract before I came here. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to publish 68 books, and, you know, 25, it's not far enough along.
No, so it's not.
There's a creator in me who's sort of impatient to get some more out.
Well, yeah, if the goal is 68, you've got some work to do.
Apparently.
Which means I have more great interviews for you down the road. I'm looking forward to that.
A scholar.
Yeah. Well, you call yourself a dream traveler, and truly I see you that way. But what is a dream travel, and when do you start doing it? How does this play in your daily life?
Well, you know, this is a book of stories, not theories, so it actually shows you what it means to be a dream traveler. It shows you that in dreams, yes, sleep dreams, but also conscious, lucid dreams, shamanic journeys, you can travel beyond the world we know into other realms. For example, realms where the dead are alive. I spent a lot of time all of my life talking to people who are considered to be dead in this world, but are doing perfectly well or otherwise in other realms of reality. So you can talk the dead in the realms where they are alive. You can go to parallel worlds where your parallel self is doing something different, and this can be very, very interesting. It will certainly expand your view of reality. You might even maybe be able to negotiate with the parallel self about what gifts and benefits you can bring to each other. You know, it's about traveling to all the hidden dimensions of reality that physics tells us are more likely than not. But being a dream traveler is not just about getting out there, Richard. It's about getting with it on the roads of ordinary life. A lot of the stories, as you've seen, have a lot of territory covered in this world, extraordinary territory, the mountains of Transylvania, the ancient city of the goddess in Ephesus, and so on, or strange encounters on airplanes, simply. But a lot of being a dream traveler for me is about being open to the magic of synchronicity when symbols seem to erupt around you in life in a dreamlike way, when mind and matter are clearly interweaving, when sometimes you feel the universe just got personal and hidden hands are at play. And, you know, living that way brings a fizz, a crackle of magic, you know, to everything. So it's not just about this or that. It's about being more open and available to experiences beyond the ordinary, you know, grasp of the everyday mind, whether you're walking around with open-eyed or whether your eyes are closed and you are sleeping or traveling in dreaming.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the word synchronicity, and you say that synchronicity is when the universe gets personal. So how does that work?
Well, we all feel it. Everybody knows that moment when you feel in your shivers that something extraordinary is happening. So what science tells us is there is no division between mind and matter anywhere in the multidimensional universe, that what we are thinking and feeling influence what is around us. This isn't just a New Age version of the law of attraction. It's what hard science suggests as well. So one aspect of synchronicity is that what is in you and with you interacts with the world around you and helps to generate the events and encounters that you experience. There's something beyond that, which is very central to these stories in the new book. It's what Jung meant when he said once that we travel in a circumambient atmosphere. That's the phrase I want to quote, a circumambient atmosphere that includes not only our personal thoughts and feelings, but our connections with people at a distance. That sounds like quantum physics, with archetypes, with gods, goddesses, spirits of nature, etc., with the dead who might be with us, with the bigger stories. I think that that's correct. I think that we experience reality differently according to what is with us. And by that, I mean, beyond anything else, what story you are carrying. Are you just going around with your personal histories, or are you in some sense in league with a larger story, a bigger drama? Yeah. When that happens, you start living mythically and things happen big time. And you can't mistake the fact that the world is not ordinary anymore, because the world is with you and alive and conscious all around you.
I've had a lot of people tell me, Robert, that they don't remember their dreams. Probably a lot of people experience that. But when they tell you that, what do you share with them?
Well, I begin with great sympathy, because a dream drought is almost pandemic in our culture. Most people, I mean, many people are not remembering their dreams. They don't have a practice of recording and sharing dreams, even when they do remember something. So the first thing I would say is, you're not alone. I mean, relax. Here's how you can begin to break a dream drought if you want to. And you really should want to, because you're missing the movies. You're missing great entertainment. You're missing great travels, which don't cost you a buck in ordinary reality. You're missing tuning into a voice of conscience, a witness perspective on your actions and attitudes that might be an invaluable course corrective. You're missing out on your ability to scout the possible future. You're missing out on conversations with grandma and other interesting people on the other side. You're missing out on that and so much more. So if you're interested, you'd like to change, well, first of all, be kind to your fragments. When people say they don't remember dreams, usually there's something. It might just be a wisp. It might just be a number, sense of color, a bit of a song, something. But very often, you know, before you say to yourself, I've got nothing, pause again and think, maybe you've got a little something. And linger in bed or think under the shower whether something might be with you. And above all, spend some time in those in-between states between sleep and awake. So many people wake up during the night. Very few people, unless they're heavily medicated or deeply drunk, are going to sleep for 7-8 hours without stirring. The in-between states of consciousness between sleep and awake, the hypnagogic zone, is a great, it's prime time for waking up to your dreams. It's prime time for finding spontaneous images. You're psychically alert, you're intuitive, transpersonal conversations can begin, and you can embark on lucid dreaming. I also say to people, you know, the world around you, as we've been discussing, will speak to you in the manner of a dream. If you don't have dreams, we'll go out in the world and collect the first three odd things, the first unusual things, then enter your field of perception and begin to make a story out of them. You've got a theme on your mind, carry the theme. I'd like guidance on such and such. Go out into the world. Let the first odd thing that pops up, the kids chalk drawing on the street, the behavior of that dog, an overheard voice on a cell phone, let that be a message to you from the world. And you know what? You'll discover the world is alive and dreamlike, and when you discover that, sometimes it opens the spigot of your dreams. I'll say one more thing very briefly, and I'll try and slow down because I know I can go a bit fast. You know, we urgently need in our society a way of telling stories to each other that makes it socially rewarding to bring something to the table.
Yeah.
Probably the most important single technique I've devised as a teacher is what we call the lightning dreamwork technique. It's a very simple four-step technique by which we can hear each other much better. When someone wants to tell a story or a dream from life, even the most intimate one, we can listen, we can be respectful, we can offer feedback in the right way, and we can guide them towards action. When you learn that simple technique, you have a powerful incentive to bring something to your friend or your circle any time at the breakfast table, in the coffee clutch, whatever. You've got a social reward system. Our society has lacked that. There's a terrifying story in the new book, Mysterious Realities, called Dream Takers, which raises the question, just how deeply are we in trouble as a society if we are all losing our dreams? Does it mean we've lost a vital part of our soul? Does it mean that we don't have values anymore? Does it mean we can't hear the voice of conscience? Does it mean that we're less than human? I raise all of those questions just in the way that indigenous traditions raise them. amongst the Iroquois, or Iroquois, whose languages I speak and who I had to get to know because of my dreams, they say traditionally, if you've lost your dreams, it's because you've lost a part of your soul, a part of you that is the dreamer, and that is a very serious condition.
Well, what's going on with what many call recurring dreams? You tell a hilarious story about that in the story, When the Same Dream Keeps Playing.
Well, let me just summarize that story. It's one of my favorites, one of the funniest. There's no lack of humor in this book, is there, Richard?
No.
But this is probably maybe the funniest. So it actually came from, like all the other stories in the book, they might read like fiction, but they've all come from my life in one reality or another. So I'm at the breakfast table at one of my trainings. I teach teachers of active dreaming, and there's a very elegant, very well-spoken physician from England at the table. She's using very bad words. Oh, Robert, why do I keep having the same effing dream? I mean, she's really very foul at the breakfast table. And I'm rather shocked because she's a very genteel, you know, well brought up lady. I say, what's the matter? She says, I keep dreaming I've got to do my effing medical exams again, and I did them 30 years ago, and I'm effing fed up with the dream. And having explored briefly the fact that if I dream I've got to do a test again, it might mean that in the school of life I'm facing a new test, I decide just to go to town with a different kind of explanation. I say, listen, my dear, while you're complaining about having the same effing dream, there is a movie production company in Dreamland that makes dreams for you, and they are so effing fed up with the fact that you will not get the message, will not do anything about it. And strike action is threatened because they are so bored with having to make the same effing dream for you. And, you know, the lead actor wants been cloned, play the romantic lead in some really wonderful film and not have to play this role of someone who wants you to do your exam. And she cracks up. She's doubled up with laughter. So I wrote a story, and I think it's not entirely removed from the way things work, about how behind the scenes, and this goes on in some dreams, I think, we have a movie production company that is producing an entertainment or an education for us. The recurring dream that comes again and again, maybe with small changes, might be precisely what I suggested in that conversation and in the story. It might be precisely coming again because some group that actually means as well wants us to get a message and or take action on it.
Yeah, yeah. Over the years that I have had you on this show, interviewing you over many of your amazing books, you have a lot of incredible stories. You mentioned the word movie production company. I have to ask, have you ever been approached by a TV production company or movie company to do your life or to just share your stories because they're rich?
I was on a famous overnight show many years ago when one of my books called The Dreamer's Book of the Dead came out. And a Hollywood producer did contact me and said, I'd like to make a movie based on your life. I mean, not the biography of Robert, but based on the life of someone who can step in and out of time, meet other people in certain locales, etc. He was very excited.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I had a lot to do and I never received the treatment. So that opportunity I allowed to blow by. In my dreams, someone smart is going to recognize that Mysterious Realities, the new book, has the stuff of a sort of twilight zone for dreamers, because all the stories are based on dreams and synchronicity from regular life. And they've got these little introductions, which you could imagine Rod Serling speak, but actually it's my voice. In my dream, someone is going to wake up to the fact that we have here a TV series in Mysterious Realities of a most unusual kind. That would be lovely, of course.
Yes.
And that would give huge impetus to the books that are going to follow it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I see that happening. That's so cool. You say that you're time travelers in our dreams, visiting past, visiting future, parallel times, any night of the week. How can we become conscious time travelers and use our ability to scout the possible future to make better choices?
Well, it's a very
choices?
Good question. Probably it begins with waking up to the fact that we're already doing it. I mean, again, people don't remember their dreams and they don't look at them carefully enough.
Right.
But if you will start following the discipline of recording your dreams in a journal is your most essential tool to get good at any of this. You have to keep a record and have to learn how to journal well, and I teach people how to do that, of course. It's a very creative form of record keeping. If you journal your dreams over time, you're going to notice at some point you've dreamed some physical event before it happened. Okay. Once you've noticed that as a matter of first-hand experience and record, you're starting to get ready to do the interesting things. One of the interesting things is to say, okay, if I can see the future, then maybe I can change the future for the better. If I can see the future, maybe I can change the road that I'm on if I don't like it. If I can't see the future, maybe I'm going to end up where I'm headed. But maybe if I recognize that I have the ability to see ahead of myself, because consciousness is so mobile, maybe then I can make better choices about which possible future I wish to manifest. Mm-hmm. And when that kind of thinking is with you, and when you're starting to experiment, what you then do is you learn to journey. You learn to travel through the gateway of your dreams and get more information. It might begin by saying, okay, I dream such and such. I dreamed I'm in that room with a movie producer somewhere. I'd like to know who it is, when, where, how. So I'm going to put myself back inside the dream. I'm teaching a basic technique now, Richard. The technique is called dream reentry. You've dreamed something. You want to know more. You want to go on with it. You want more information. You can learn to put yourself back into the space of the dream. A dream is a place. You can go there again. You've been there already. You can go there again. Then you get more information, and then you apply it.
Yeah.
Now you're starting to learn the basics for a time traveler who can do this perhaps in sleep, but can certainly learn to do it in lucid dreaming or shamanic journeying. In the workshops, we use shamanic drumming. We don't use hallucinogens. We manufacture our own internal chemicals. But we use percussion, we use shamanic drumming as a kind of sheepdog to herd the brainwaves in the right direction while we travel. And we might travel into the possible future, we might travel into the past, maybe into another life somewhere else that's relevant to us now, maybe into a parallel time. So I'm talking about techniques that can be learnt. They can be learnt. We all basically have some material which qualifies us to get started because we all have dreams. We may not remember them, but we all have some degree of access. And physics is telling us that we're all living in the field of non-local mind. So once you start finding a personal doorway to the vast quantum information field around you, you might find that you're able to do far more in terms of growing consciousness and bringing information from beyond the ordinary routine into your ken than you had thought possible.
The many worlds theory in physics says that we're living in one of the countless parallel universes that are constantly splitting and interacting. And many of your stories, The Other Novelist, Heaven on Earth, Dream Interruptus, involve awakening to parallel selves on different event tracks. Tell us why you think that dreaming is the best way for us to gain firsthand knowledge of parallel worlds and parallel lives.
Well, I say this because it's my experience, having kept a journal for many, many decades now, with tens of thousands of reports. It's my personal experience that I find myself in dreams, night dreams now. I'm not talking about lucid dreams or shamanic journey. That might deepen the experience. I'm just talking about what goes on any night. I find myself again and again and again and again in the life of several parallel Roberts in particular who made different choices. The two who interest me both are also writers, but they're writing different things. One of them is a wildly successful author of superior spy fiction set in the mid-20th century. And I like his adventures. I like his research. I like accompanying him as he, you know, is working on his books. Another one started writing books for kids and young adults some time ago. And I write a funny story about my attempt to get into his life. And the fact that he said, "You can't get into my life, Robert. I'm the one who finished that book. You didn't." But more recently, I sat down and had lunch with him in a conscious journey. We've come to an arrangement. So we'll see how that works. No kidding. If it's fantasy, it's kind of fantasy as it works. So, and I noticed for other people too. I talked to other people who are in the habit of recording their dreams. They say, "Oh, yes, I dream again and again, and I'm still with Bill." "Who's Bill?" "Oh, he's my ex. We got divorced 15 years ago, but we're still together in dreams, and life is going on as if I made a different choice." Now, a shamanic type might say that might be indicative of soul loss. You split. Part of you didn't want to leave the marriage, and part of you is still with your ex. And that might be part of the story, too. But it's also quite possible that this is an accurate vision of a parallel life track in which you stayed with your ex, and life is going on, for good or bad, the way that it might. So dreaming is our way, our easiest way on the human level of understanding the many worlds hypothesis from physics. Again, the material is available to you if you'll just follow the discipline of recording your dreams and looking for those episodes which seem to run like a, you know, long-running serial drama over many years, maybe a sitcom, maybe, or maybe a horror show, depending on what's going on. And then you might be able to learn to do it consciously as well. You might be able to learn to journey in the way that shamans do and track your parallel self and, as I say, maybe do some good for each other.
Yeah, yeah. Some of your personal experiences of synchronicity are so wild. We know you're not making them up. I know, definitely you're not making them up. Tell us about your encounter with the Death's Head dominatrix on the airplane. It was in a storytelling
okay.
This is
one of my favorites. We'll give it a few minutes, I hope.
Please.
We'll keep it short because I don't want to rush it.
Yeah.
The background is I was leading a writing retreat. Writing is a state of conscious dreaming. It's possibly the most unusual writing workshop in the world, actually. And to goose myself up to do the writing exercises while my students are doing them too, I start writing a story in which an author makes a deal with death. The deal is he has to entertain death with a new story every day, or else he'll be taken out, right? And within that frame story, it's a bit like Scheherazade, within that frame story, he starts writing a piece about a Roman centurion whose girlfriend is a Phoenician witch who's very good at dreams. So that's the introduction. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm on my plane flying home, and as always, I'm curious to see what chance encounters will come up. And coming along the aisle is a very tall woman in high-heeled black boots, wearing a black top hat, all black leather over a bustier, and she sits next to me and parks a small male companion next to the window. She has on her hands gloves with cut-out fingers and huge death's heads on the back of the gloves, so I'm looking at this with interest. She sniffs, looks around the plane and opens conversation by saying, "Oh, I like this flight. All the seats are full. Actuarially, you know, if the plane is going to crash, 20% of the seats will be empty." So this is the start of the conversation. Very soon in the conversation, she makes it known that her profession is dominatrix. At this point, I'm silenced for a while because S&M is not my scene, and for once, I'm rather tongue-tied. But the conversation picks up again, and just to give you a couple of episodes, she says, it's a gusting conversation. It stops and starts. It's exactly the way I describe in the book. I haven't improved it at all. Actually, I may have toned it down a little bit. She says at a certain point, "Do you think the dead talk to us in our dreams?" And I say, "Absolutely." She knows nothing about me yet, by the way. "Oh, good," she says. "My ex-husband, who was shot in the face in a diner last year, he was a well-known rock musician, was in the paper. My dead husband turned up last week, stood over me in bed and said, 'I've got a good job now, a cool job. I'm doing music and special effects that people experience in their dreams.' What do you think of that?" She said, "That was a really good story." It goes on like this. Suddenly, she really hits me. She says, "I'd love to read a story from the point of view of Jezebel, and I'm trying to remember my Bible." And she fills in the gap for me. She says, "Those Phoenician witches were so good at dreams, it's as if her dead husband or someone was whispering in her ear about the story I was writing just before I made my return journey." Now we cut to the chase, and this is the story. This is the title of the opening story in the collection, A Storytelling of Crows. She says, "I love crows and ravens." She says, "Of course you do." She says, "Do you know the name for a collective of crows or ravens?" And I'm proud of myself. "Oh, yes, yes, it's a murder of crows and an unkindness of ravens." She sniffs. "Everybody knows that," she says. "I really just don't think they do, but that's what she says to me." "There's another word. It can be a group of crows or a group of ravens. Don't you know it?" "No, I don't know it. You're going to tell me." "Yes." "Yes. It's a storytelling of crows, a storytelling of ravens. Do you want to know why?" "Of course." This is the conversation. She says, "Well, I watched this once. I watched A Storytelling of Crows gathered, listening to a crow telling them a story. The storyteller was unsatisfactory. When he finished, they pecked him to death." Pause. Silence. "The whole thing, Richard, seems to have been custom-made for me, absolutely fitting in with the story I was writing, and of course, wonderful material for the story I put in the book, which is all about a writer who's made a deal with death." Yeah. There's more in the story than I've told you now. Yeah, there's a face-up, close-up, terrifying encounter with a personified death that begins the whole book. Mm. When things are as specific as this, and this happens to me a lot, mm-hmm. you can hardly fail to notice that there is a secret logic to life. There are powers beyond the ordinary who are at play, and maybe mm-hmm. they're enjoying themselves hugely. There are moments when I can feel forces, intelligences beyond the curtain of the world snickering and giggling and saying, "Should we give him another one? Or has he got enough now? Is this enough for now?" And there's something else, Richard, but I think you will recognize. It's the law of attraction, but again, not the silly saccharine New Age version.
Right, right.
The law of attraction works. We do attract or repel things according to the energy we carry. And one of the energies I carry is that of someone who loves stories. So stories come to me.
Yeah.
Stories come to me. The Australian Aborigines talk about stories as if they have their own life, their own volition. Stories come to me just like that.
You create also a lot of playful and delicious words, and one of my favorite Robert Moss words is chiromancer. I remember when I read that one of your earlier books, and it's used to describe someone who's poised to recognize and act in special kairos moments of synchronicity. How do we become chiromancers?
Well, we've got to be open and we've got to be available. I mean, Kairos time is jump time. It's opportunity time. I borrowed the name of an interesting Greek god who's not Kronos, the god of linear time. Kairos is depicted as a handsome young guy who's hairless except for a lock of hair across his forehead, from which we get the phrase, grab time by the forelock. When he's in play, you got to grab fast. You must not miss it. So Chiromancer is someone who is open to new experience, not going around with blinkers, and available to new experience and ready to say thank you for new experience and ready to do something to capitalize on a special moment of opportunity. So this is the kind of personality you need to become. You need to drop the attitudes in life that keep you forever on schedule doing the same-o. You have to drop the part of yourself that wants no surprises. That part of you is going to get in the way till it's blown apart by some play of synchronicity that's so big you can't ignore it. You've got to get off your maps, get out of your routines, get off your charts. At least for a certain period of the day, you might say, well, I can't do that. I'm too busy. I've got too many responsibilities. You can schedule some unscheduled time, 20 minutes during the lunch break, your morning commute. The morning dog walk is when it starts me. I walk my funny little dog towards the park and things start exploding in, positively in terms of synchronicity all around me because my eyes are open, I'm ready, and I enjoy it. Yeah. So this is a way of having a lot more fun in everyday life. Actually puts a champagne fizz of magic into whatever you encounter on a regular street corner.
Yeah. You know, I've long been fascinated with death and dying, and a lot of that is probably based on the years of hospice work that I've done. Your stories are full of encounters with the dead and visitations, and especially in visits to places where they're living on the other side. Is contact with the deceased really as natural and easy as you suggest?
Oh, I think so. I think there are three reasons why contact with the deceased isn't difficult. It's natural, not supernatural, and it's not weird. The first is they're still around. That could be good, bad, or mixed. Someone who's died might stay around for a while because, you know, they want to look in on the family and look after the family to some extent. They've got some unfinished business, but eventually, if people stay around for too long, it gets very unhealthy, and sometimes they stay around because they're addicted. They want to hang out at the same place, get another drink, get another smoke, get another fix through the living. So that can become a very confused and unhappy environment. They might stay around because they think they're going to face terrible punishment for something they did or for killing themselves. So the dead may still be with us. And as I say, that can be good, bad, or mixed. It is usually bad if it goes on for too long, if the dead remain too closely attached to the living for a long period of time, even if it's initially loving. The second reason why contact with the deceased is not strange at all is they come visiting. I mean, they come visiting. They have all sorts of reasons to come. They want to seek love and forgiveness or extend love and forgiveness. We need to understand that love and forgiveness are always available across the apparent barrier of death if we're willing to entertain that idea. They come for an update on the family. They come if they're clear, in their situation. They come with information we need to receive. My father was a great instructor for me on these things. In the year after his death, more than 30 years ago in Australia, he came to me again and again in dreams with specific practical information for the family in Australia and in England, names, details I did not have that I could pass on, which is very, very helpful. 2 years ago, Richard, having gone on somewhere else, he showed me his transitions on the other side, and then he showed me that he'd taken a certain decision and wouldn't be calling on me the same way anymore. He turned up. It's the hypnagogic state between sleep and awake. I'm up on a high rooftop, and my goodness, there's my father. That's a lucid dream. And suddenly I'm in front of him, and he points his finger at my upper lip. He says, go to a doctor and get that checked out. So I do. As soon as the office opens, I call the dermatologist. What I thought was just a mole that hadn't healed very well from a shaving cut was a spot of skin cancer, and it could be taken care of. It required surgery. You'd hardly know anything had happened, but it did need to be recognized and dealt with. The doctor, my annual physical, hadn't noticed it. I hadn't paid attention. It took my father coming from a long way away to give me that health advisory. Now, you could psychologize that and say, okay, that's an aspect of you, or that's a disease marker. Fine, it was helpful anyway. But no, I think it was Dad. So the second reason, as I say, why contact with the deceased is not weird, not supernatural, is they come calling. And the third reason, in some ways the most interesting, is that in dreaming we travel. We travel to realms where the dead are alive. And this, in addition to the second thing about visitation, is the most enduring and important source of the widespread human belief that soul or mind or consciousness survives death across the ages. Yes, churches come in and have their teachings.
Yeah.
But the primary reason throughout human history why most humans have believed in life after death is they have dreamed something that is relevant to it. They've dreamed of a visitation from a deceased person who is clearly alive, or they dreamed of traveling to realms where the deceased are alive. And we do that. Even the person who doesn't remember their dreams might be traveling tonight into the place where grandma is living right now.
Talk to us about soul loss and soul recovery. The theme of many of your stories, actually, The Lost Girl and A Fairy at the Copper Beach, Dream Takers, and also much of your work. But there's a lot of misperception, I think, about that, soul loss and soul recovery.
Well, I think on a visceral level, it's very easy for anybody to understand. We suffer pain, we suffer grief, part of us goes away. It can happen at any stage in life. It often happens in childhood. The world seems cold and cruel. It's crushing the dreams of that beautiful young person, and she or he goes away.
Yeah.
Leaves the body. Someone is incomplete. Part of your vital energy and identity is gone. Your magical child might have gone. Your beautiful, bright dreamer might have gone. And that might be why many years later in adult life, you don't remember any dreams because you lost the dreamer. Shamans call this soul loss. It's recognized widely in ancient indigenous cultures, and it's recognized today in a very powerful and valid school of healing. I mean, being an ecumenical school of healing, the different approaches to soul recovery. I prefer, rather than doing the classical shamanic soul retrieval operation, in which the practitioner makes a journey, finds what's missing, and blows it back into the body, I prefer to help people become the shamans of their own souls and the healers of their own lives by opening to dreams. And as they bring back the dreams, they find they're bringing back parts of their soul. The story of the lost girl and the fairy of the Copper Beach is a literal just-so story of what happened to one woman in one of my workshops. The workshop was actually in Prague. And her return to the Vienna of the park and the Copper Beach, where she'd been kissed for the first time, age 14, and then lost her thought, a part of her 14-year-old self. That is exactly as it played out. Richard, I haven't hyped the story one little bit. Every detail in the story is exactly as it played out with the permission of the woman that I wrote about, actually wrote me today about her rapture at reading the story in this form. So I've had a certain amount of experience of what it means not only to suffer soul loss. I suffered soul loss as a kid because I was so lonely and so sick. I had double pneumonia in both lungs 12 times between the ages of 3 and 11. I have some experience in my life of what it's like to lose a vital part of yourself because circumstances are bad. And I found that the techniques that I reflect in the stories and mysterious realities and discuss more openly in books like Dreaming the Soul Back Home offer a valid, authentic, and tremendously empowering and healing modality for all of us who are interested to bring more of ourselves into the body, to bring more of our parts together, including that magical child and that beautiful, young, bright dreamer.
Yeah, Robert, many of your stories come from your practice and teaching of active dreaming, something you created. What is active dreaming and what goes on in one of the workshops you teach?
Well, yes, thank you for the question. I mean, it's the phrase of the provocation. It's meant to rouse people, stir them up, because when people think about dreams, they think it's a passive activity. You lie down, you have a dream, or dream has you. So it already says in its punchy way, you can get active about dreaming. And it has, active dreaming, as I teach and practice, it has three primary modes of operation. The first is it's a way of getting active with your dreams. It's a way of talking about your dreams, recording your dreams, taking action from your dreams that brings some energy, some healing, some guidance from the dream world into regular life. And that is actually real magic. Real magic in my lexicon is the art of bringing gifts from one world to another world. So it's about getting active with dreams, having a better way of talking about them, and always looking for clearly a creative healing strategy to follow the guidance of the dream. Secondly, it's a method of lucid dreaming. It's a very high-octane method of lucid dreaming. We could say it's shamanic lucid dreaming, where we bring in the drumming and the journeying. And yet it's also terribly easy and available because I teach people to spend more time in that twilight state between sleep and awake and become lucid dreamers there. And I teach people how a personal image that belongs to you from your dreams or even your life memories can be the portal for a journey, the dream reentry technique. So secondly, it's a modality with many techniques involved of shamanic lucid dreaming. And thirdly, we've talked a bit about this, it's a mode of getting lucid and active about dreaming in everyday life, learning to see the world around you as a waking dream and learning to recognize and play with the symbols around you and always, always, always to be ready to seize those magic moments of synchronicity.
Your subtitle is intriguing, A Dream Traveler's Tales from the Imaginal Realm. I've got to ask, what is the imaginal realm for you?
Well, it's a term that I borrowed actually from medieval Sufis. They called it the alam al-hayal or the alam al-mital, which can be translated this way. The descriptor imaginal is meant to separate what we're talking about from the kind of imaginary situation that people reject as just fantasy or idle stuff. Imaginal relates to the true imagination and its operations. Imagination in Blake's sense, or Coleridge's sense, the creative imagination that can create realities, create worlds. The imaginal realm is a realm in non-ordinary reality that is no less real than this physical world. It's a place where poets and mystics and shamans and creators have always wanted to go and have often succeeded in going. There are schools there are temples there are places of initiation and healing there. It is to be explored through direct experience. It's between time and eternity. So if you travel to this realm, you're outside linear time, then you can pop back in the past or the future or parallel times. Mm-hmm. And it interfaces and intersects with realms of the afterlife or the interlife, where the intelligent deceased are having their time, going on to the activities they love. An afterlife like the one that Jung is depicted as having in my story, The Other Bollingen, a life of continued scholarship, animated and partly directed by a desire to be a teacher and mentor to other people, including people who are having lives in this world right now. Mm-hmm. So it's a term for this order of reality. And it all centers on the idea that the imagination creates worlds, and that this is a place we can travel to if we develop the arts and have the desire and appetite to go there.
Yeah. A couple of characters that have always intrigued me in history, and you write about them in this book. You write that before he died, Carl Jung started dreaming of the other Bollingen, a home in the afterlife, and that this actually removed any fear of death for him.
Yes.
Do you think you're actually with Carl Jung, because you recount an extraordinary conversation with him in a dream, in a place like
yes.
that?
Yes, well, yes, I think I was, actually. I mean, we can discuss this. Is this Carl Jung, the spirit intelligence of Carl Jung, the individual? Is it part of Robert projected that
sure.
he loves Carl Jung, as I do?
Sure.
Is it some personality essence putting on a certain face? I actually think that it was a conversation with Jung. And the other Bollingen, we know that from Barbara Hanna, the analyst who wrote a very fine biographical study of Jung. She wrote about the fact that Jung dreamed of an astral version, an other side version of his sanctuary on the lake near the village of Bollingen, and that removed his fear of death, and he was ready to go there and knew where he was going. Well, I was leading a group journey. We're actually up in the mountains of Transylvania. I teach in some interesting places. I'm leading a group journey for people, and the intention is to have timely and helpful communication with someone on the other side of death. And I'm using a certain script derived from my own experiences, an original script, to get started on the journey. It involves going through a certain place to a place of water, and there's a boat in the water. And I'm doing the journey. I'm drumming for the group, and I'm doing the journey myself. And there in the boat is the man in a straw hat, in a straw boater, smoking a pipe. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe that it's Jung, but it seems to be Jung. And he invites me to his tower on the lake, and it's much bigger than it was in his lifetime. He worked on it all his life, and he shows me some pages, just a few, of the book he's been working on, which he says is his masterwork. It's the purple book, not the red book. It's titled in Latin, means the book of heaven. He won't let me see very much, but he shows me mischievously at one point. He shows me the title of the introduction of the book he's been writing on the other side. And the title of Jung's introduction is Why I Am Not a Jungian. Of course, this is going to inflame some of my Jungian friends. First of all, it's scandalous that Moss thinks he can talk to Jung. But although we know that Jung talked to the dead all his life. He did it all his life. He wrote about it again and again. So Jung would not, if he were around, would not think it's extraordinary at all to think you can have a conversation with a great mind on the other side of death. But perhaps some Jungians will have trouble with the idea that he would talk to anyone in particular like this. This is a just-so story. Once again, I haven't hyped it. I haven't improved it.
Yes.
It is remarkable. It is a thriller, but it's just exactly the way it played out. And in the story, you'll also see another element of practice, because you'll see me going back into this scene with two trackers, two other shamanic journeyers who trained with me, and we're all getting multiple impressions from different angles of what is going on here. We're allowed to see different things. We're able to compare our travel reports. That's one of the things I teach people, and it's one of the things reflected in some of the stories. We might think of dreaming as a solitary activity, but no, not only are we often quite social in our dreams, but we can learn to dream together. We can learn to make dreams with journeys with partners or whole groups of people. We have tremendous fun doing this, of course, in my workshops.
Okay, so, all right, so collective dreaming. We can do that, like collective consciousness.
Well, collective is a big word. I'd like to think of it as group dreaming, or partner dreaming, or interactive or mutual dreaming. I mean, a collective dream would be a hard thing to engineer, and maybe not something we want, because collective, you know, thought forms can be very destructive. But what I know and what I teach people to do, and have been teaching them to do successfully for decades now, Richard, is I teach them we can travel together. We have an agreed destination. We're going to go and explore something. We're going to try and change something for the better, maybe during the journey, and bring back gifts and compare our reports. And when you learn to do this, you begin to accumulate objective evidence from experience that there are worlds beyond the physical. You can go there, you can explore them, you can bring back gifts.
It was amazing for me to learn, Robert, in your story, A God of Freud, that Freud, who called himself godless, treasured his personal collection of 3,000 statuettes of ancient deities and turned to some of them as counselors. Tell us about this and also about his relations with Jung, another theme in your book.
Well, I'm very proud of my story, A God of Jung. It came to me during one of my writing retreats when I had a series of three dreams, sepia dreams, with the quality of those old photographs. And I thought, whose dreams are these? And I thought they could just be Freud's dreams. So it turns on my dreaming three dreams, which I thought just maybe they have the quality of Freud's own dreams. And I brought that together with the astonishing effect that visiting his last home in Hampstead in London had on me some years ago. It was his last home. He'd been forced out of Vienna by the Nazis. He'd gone to London. He managed to take 2,000 of his gods with him. There were originally 3,000. He got 2,000 out, for which he was very grateful. He surrounded himself all his life with living statues. I mean, these things, the statue of Athena, the statue of Osiris, the statue of Kuan Yin, etc., these were not made as tourist items. They were believed to be ensouled. They were believed to carry spiritual energy. And Freud treated them like that. He talked to them. He would promote one and then another to be a special advisor. When he's dealing with a client, he would sometimes place one of his statues between himself and the client, maybe as a psychic shield, or move one closer to him on the desk so he'd have its counsel. He refused to go anywhere for most of his life without a suitcase full, literally, of what he called his old and grubby gods. So we have an interesting, you know, an interesting counterpoint here. On the one hand, we have someone who calls himself a godless Jew and claims to be an atheist. On the other hand, we have someone whose respect for the old gods in the forms the ancients gave them is as reverential or superstitious as you like as that of any ancient from pagan times. And these are essentially, quote, unquote, pagan deities. Very few of them are Buddhist, for example. I don't think any of them are Christian. Obviously, none of them are Jewish. They're mostly from the ancient world, from the Greco-Roman world, from Egypt, from Mesopotamia. And he understood, the Greeks used to call statues like this the breathing images. Freud understood them the same way. So in that story, we go deep into an aspect of Freud's mind and his practice, which is rarely featured in most of the writings on Jung, on Freud. As for his breakup with Jung, that is a fascinating story. Jung says in my story about him that Freud's attitudes have evolved in a positive way since he's been dead, but they don't spend much time together. Their bust-up was one of the great, you know, bust-ups in the history of intellectual life, and I don't know if they have time to get into it now, but it was accompanied by synchronicity of the most extraordinary kind, and Jung had to break with Freud because Jung had to find a larger container for his dream life than Freud's theories afforded it.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a film in the late 90s that I found very intriguing. It was called Being John Malkovich.
Yes.
I see a film about you, Being Robert Moss. That would be most entertaining.
Now you're really scaring me.
Well, Robert Moss, it has been such a delight to have you back on the program. I love reading your books. It was a joy to meet you last year when you came to Indianapolis. This new book, Mysterious Realities, A Dream Traveler's Tales from the Imaginal Realm, and I love your website because it's easy to remember. I encourage all my listeners to visit you online at mossdreams.com.
Wonderful, Richard. And I should mention, I'm coming back to India. I'll be back in Indianapolis to do an evening workshop called Soul in the Multiverse and to do a book signing at a local bookstore in February.
Awesome. I thought I read that about that. I'll check on that and put it on the calendar.
I think the details are up at my website. Okay. Anyway, that's on the calendar.
That sounds wonderful. Robert Moss, thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Once again, his website is mossofdreams.com. And now I want to share with you something he wrote in the introduction of his book. It's called Welcome to the Imaginable Realm. There is a world between time and eternity, with structures created by thought that outlast anything on earth. This is the imaginable realm. You may enter it through the gate of dreams, or the gate of death, or on nights when you drop your body like a bathrobe. Here you will find schools and palaces, places of adventure, healing, and initiation. The imaginable realm is a fundamental ground of knowledge and experience. It's a region of mind between the world of time and the world of eternity. In this realm, human imagination meets intelligence from higher realities, and they construct places of healing, instruction, and initiation. Here, ideas and powers beyond the grasp of the ordinary human mind, call them archetypes, tutelary spirits, gods, or daemons, take on guises humans can begin to perceive and understand. Well, the great medieval Sufi philosopher Suhrawardi insisted on the objective reality of the imaginable realm, and he also insisted that the way to grasp it is the way of experience. Quote, pilgrims of the spirit succeed in contemplating this world, and they find there every object of their desire. To know the realm of true imagination, you must go there yourself. Happily for you, once you wake up to what's going on, the doors may open to you any night in dreams, or in the fertile place between sleep and waking, or in a special moment of synchronicity when the universe gets personal and you know, through your shivers, that great powers are in play. In dreams, we awaken to other orders of reality. When we wake up in our regular bodies, we may have fallen asleep in another world. Sometimes, lying in the drifty state near sleep, I sense that as I grow drowsy, a second self, back to back with me on the bed, is stirring awake, ready to prowl. I call him the Traveler. I track the Traveler by recording his exploits, the ones I manage to catch, in my journal. In one report, he seems to be very like myself itself, just 2 days ahead of me, on my present probable event track. Sometimes he's much further ahead, or on a different event track, or in another body, in another time, or another world. The Traveler's tales in this book are just so stories in the sense that they spring from direct experience in the imaginable realm, my own and that of other dream travelers who have shared their adventures with me. This territory is more familiar to you than you may currently realize. You are a traveler in your dreams, whether or not you remember them. You visit realms where the dead are alive. You travel into the possible future, scouting the roads that lie ahead. You travel into the past, into scenes from your present life and other lives that are part of your story. You go to studio sets where dream movies are made by production crews behind the scenes to arouse and entertain or to shock dreamers awake. You slip into parallel lives where your parallel selves are moving on different event tracks because they made different choices. Now, what is going on in your dreams doesn't necessarily stop when you wake up or switch to a different screen. The action may play on like episodes in a television series that continue to run after you turn off the set. It gets more interesting. When you exit a scene from a life you were leading somewhere else, you may or may not remember where you were and who you are in that other world. When you do remember, you tag what lingers in your mind as a dream. When you exit a dream, that is also a visit to the parallel life. Your parallel self continues on its way, and while you go about your day, your other self may dream of you. In this book, Mysterious Realities, you'll confirm that the doors to the imaginable realm open from wherever you are. You'll see what it means to live on a mythic edge. At any moment, you may fall, like the author, into the lap of a goddess or the jaws of an archetype. Are you ready? Here's a survival tip. Don't go to any world without your sense of humor. I love how Robert Moss writes. More than that, I have gleaned so much about his wisdom regarding the interpretation of dreams. Once again, Robert Moss has been my guest. His website is mossdreams.com, and now here is a word from our great sponsors.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Goddess Mountain Naturals crafts quality salves and balms intended to aid in healing and rejuvenation of the skin and body through properties provided by nature. The various salves help to moisturize your skin, soothe itching caused by bug bites and poison ivy. These salves have been found to ease pain from sore muscles and tendons and aid in the healing of cuts and scrapes. These are remedies that have been used for thousands of years. For more information, you can visit www.goddessmountain.com. That's goddessmountain.com.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
In closing, here's an encore excerpt from an interview I did a few years ago back with the great author Marianne Williamson.
You say also in your book that when we forget that we are love, then we forget to love.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That our identity is love, our genuine reality is love, and we are, as it were, hanging out in a realm of consciousness which is alien to our natural being.
Mm-hmm.
Because our natural being is love, and here we are living on a planet dominated by fear. No wonder we feel crazed, neurotic, stressed, like we're aliens in our own on our own planet. No wonder we feel something off inside. It's because something is off in this world.
Mm-hmm. And the mystic has tools available to them, spiritual principles. You equate them to like magic wands. Talk about those wands for a minute.
Well, I'm fascinated by the story of Cinderella and what happens when the fairy godmother shows up and points her wand in the direction of circumstances that then transform because she does. I think that there's a real metaphysical equivalent to this, and that is that a wand is a kind of focused thought or principle. And when you apply the thinking, a certain kind of thinking to a situation, then that situation does transform. So the principles or wands that I talk about in the book, there are five of them.
Mm-hmm.
One is the thought, as you stand within any situation, that no matter what's going on now, a miracle could happen, that I'm open to the possibility of infinite possibility. Number two, the realization that every thought of judgment I think blocks the light. Number three, that we are the angels we're waiting for, that we must become in the circumstances that matter to us, people that display the characteristics of the greatest nobility and virtue and love and blessing. Number four is related to that. It's that the end is inherent in the means, meaning who we become, who we are as people, ultimately determines where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And the fifth one is that sacred silence writes the universe, which is just another way of saying that prayer and meditation every day makes all the difference.
And it really begins with law of cause and effect. What we put out will come back to us.
Absolutely.
Where we
that's
place
really
our
the
faith.
Crux of it, isn't it? That's why the golden rule is at the heart of all great religious teaching.
You mention in your book something that I really appreciated, and that is it's our task of our generation to turn love into a social force. can love be the answer when we are at a point where there's so many interesting things developing throughout the world?
Well, it's not just that love can be the answer. It's that love is the only real answer. You know, military and political solutions can manage the effects of hatred, but they can't dismantle the thought system of hatred. And hatred harnessed is what terrorism is. Terrorism is what's happened because of relatively few people have harnessed the power of hate. They've become proactive behind hate. They've trained in ways to express hate. They have an image and a vision of what they want the world to look like, and they're willing to do what it takes to make that happen. Well, the only real antidote to that is for us to do with love what they've done with hate. It's time for us to harness the powers of love, the way Gandhi did, the way Martin Luther King did. We must harness the powers of love. We must stand convicted around love. We must have an image and a vision of what we want the world to look like. We must train, which is what a mystical journey is, in ways of becoming conduits for love. Behind everything that's going on in the world is a great spiritual contest between the ways of fear and the ways of love. And the only way we can really weigh in on the side of love is by seeking to triumph within our own selves, that we might become conduits of it more effectively in our own environments and in the world than we ever have been before.
So really, we're not to ignore what you might call the darkness, but we're to transform it by the light.
Right. There's a difference between denial and transcendence. Denial that just means I'm not going to look at it, that's not transcendence. That's a negative denial. Positive denial is when you're willing to look at something in the eye, but to simply deny its power over you, given that you are a child of God.
Mm-hmm. So how do we raise this consciousness globally in terms of the transforming power of love as a social force?
Well, I don't think that we can try to change other people. I think we begin by making sure that we ourselves are doing as well as we can. And when we do that, it's like God gives you a piece of the garden to tend to. And when you've tended to your own piece of the garden, a bigger piece is given you. So I don't think any of us can, like, set out to take the globe, but we can we can reclaim our own lives. And as we do so, the capacity that we have within our own lives to be of greatest effect, that begins to just happen automatically.
How much of that, Marianne, is people not understanding just who they are as a child of God?
Well, theoretically, that's everything. Theoretically, that's the essential problem. That's the essential original sin. Sin is an archery term. It means you miss the mark. It means a misperception. So the original misperception is that we've forgotten who we are. We have forgotten that we are creations of an infinitely powerful God who has actually shared that power with us. And when our hearts are aligned with his love and his blessing, then miracles arise automatically out of what we say, what we do, and what we think. And we have been trained to not believe that. And for us to unlearn the thinking of the world and to relearn the thinking of grace, of blessing, of forgiveness, and of love will lift us into another dimension of experience entirely. And as we are lifted, then everything that does not resonate with that falls of its own dead weight.
And that as children...
You just heard an interview I had done, at least an excerpt from it, from Marianne Williamson. I want to thank my special guest today, Robert Moss. Once again, his website is mossdreams.com. And that is today's program. Our website is richardbrendan.org. A reminder that all shows are podcast on that site. And so, for that great, talented engineer, Aaron Duvall, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, and she really is an angel, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.